In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a film critic, and everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a film critic. I contribute to the website /film. For the purposes of this particular podcast, you may call me Ruckmeister McCool. Just don't call me late for dinner. And I got my sick voice today.
Oh, yeah. Late for dinner has got a very big sick voice going on.
No, I'm a little under the weather. It delayed some of our recording by a couple of days, and that's probably just something my son brought home from school. School crud. Yeah. It happens a lot.
Also, I'm not blameless myself. If you are a member of our Patreon, even a free member, you get a weekly newsletter from me. With links to Whitney and my latest work, and also life updates, some free criticism of stuff I'm watching that I don't get to write about elsewhere. And if you've been reading that, you know that I'm in the process of moving, which is chaos at the best of times. So it's been a very, very wild month.
Yeah, we're fitting in the time we can to record and get shows to you in as timely a manner as possible. Sometimes it's not super timely, but sometimes it is, and we wanted to read some of your letters, because we actually got a bunch.
We got a bunch of letters. Thank you for writing us. Whitney, take it away, my good sir. Real fast. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, if you want to send us a physical letter or a postcard, whatever you like, send it to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
All right, now take us away.
So the first letter I'm going to read comes from Brandon. Hello, Brandon.
And, hi, Brandon.
Brandon says, Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I'm writing in response to one of the questions you answered on your most recent mailbag podcast where you talked about movies for middle-aged people. First off, I want to say I'm a huge fan of the show. The two of you are my favorite movie critics in the world.
Thank you.
Pshaw. There was a point when the two of you were answering the question where Bibbs went off on a tangent about how younger moviegoers in age evolve and will find themselves drawn to movies they otherwise would have never given the time of day to in their younger years. I don't disagree with that in the slightest. My favorite movie as a teenager was Fight Club. But now, while I recognize it's actually still a good movie that's pretty well crafted and well thought out by David Fincher, if you're actually paying attention to what he has to say about male masculinity, that is, it's kind of cringe to look back on and see that movie I told all my friends was number one of all time. However, having said that, in the year of our Lord 2025, I also recognize that culture moves incredibly fast. The youngsters are watching and loving a Minecraft movie, which will surely grow up, and they will surely grow up with that movie. Maybe it will age well, maybe it won't, who is to say, but that's clearly a franchise that means something to that generation. So maybe 30 years from now, when Gen Z is a bit older and has a different view of the world, maybe there could be someone who tackles a Minecraft movie from a different perspective. It sounds ridiculous to say out loud right now, I know, but I just don't want to discount what are clearly cultural touchstones of the younger generations just because we are, quote, too old for it. So amid all the rambling, my question is, do you think we should write off a Minecraft movie, even though it's clearly IP garbage, given that it's doing something to the younger generation? Does the younger generation actually care about cinema anymore, or are they just looking for their viral chicken jockey moments to post on TikTok? Would welcome any thoughts you guys have on the subject. Sorry for the long email. Thanks for all you do, Brandon.
Never
apologize for long emails. That's what we're here for.
No. Brandon, that's a great question. And people who've been listening to the podcast for a long time might know my answer to this because it's one of my favorite expressions that I am determined to coin and no one is taking me up on it. But time is the only film critic that matters. In our time, in our lifetime, and at the moment, a movie may be a huge hit or it may be a box office dud. It may be widely talked about. It may be completely obscure. But that's in the moment. As time goes on, we'll see what kind of staying power these movies have. So I'm not eager to write any movie off. I'm not going to write it off. I may not like it and decide not to think about it, but I'm not going to write it off because, yeah, you don't know. Whitney has another expression that is relevant to this. Trash plus time equals culture.
That's trying to get that one to catch on. Nobody's taking me up on it yet.
Darren Mooney used that.
Oh, that's right. Darren Mooney quoted me in one of his YouTube videos over on, what is it, Second Wind?
Second Wind, he quoted you in a video about Star Wars The Acolyte, if memory serves. But yeah, trash plus time equals culture is basically, what we think of as trash cinema now. Give it time, because that hit a big audience that affected a big audience, and they're going to grow up with that. And they might decide retroactively, no, that was an important movie. They won't necessarily, because there's a lot of movies that are extremely popular that no one gives a damn about anymore, whether they were for young people or not. So there's no sure thing, but I'm not going to write anything off. You never know.
When it comes to something like a Minecraft movie, it's commercial garbage. I reviewed it. I gave it a semi-positive review just because it's kind of like light and whimsical, but it's not great art.
And for the record, I still haven't seen it.
The whole chicken jockey moment just taps into something about the zeitgeist. It didn't necessarily have to be that movie. Every movie has the potential to have some sort of cult moment where people can just sort of hook into it. I mean, look at Barbenheimer. People were pairing these two movies because it was kind of ironic and silly and they could brag about it. I think that's going to be a valuable experience for people. They'll remember it fondly. Also relevant is the phrase that Alonso Duralde has coined, which is it great or were you eight? The idea that it's not necessarily a great piece of cinema just because you loved it when you were 8 years old. Sometimes you can rewatch it and actually reassess it and say, actually, that was garbage.
Yeah.
I feel like there's no way. I agree with you. I think that if you're going to talk about what films sort of stay in the culture and start to actually influence other filmmakers and influence the actual medium, you do have to wait. You have to wait and see. You have to see how it sort of sticks around. Some films fade away. Some films fade away and then come back. I was just writing about It's a Wonderful Life today. It's a Wonderful Life. Lost money for RKO when it came out in 1946. It was out of the public consciousness for 30 years. Nobody really cared about that movie.
It got public domain for a while.
Yeah, it got okay reviews. It was in public domain. It fell into the public domain in the 70s, and it was around then that TV stations decided, hey, we could just throw this up around Christmas time. It's free. We may as well. And it was only through those TV repetitions that it began to regain an audience and henceforth got sort of a critical reappraisal. And look at it now. It's often considered one of the best movies of all time. So we never know. We can't really know how these things are going to evolve. And who's to say It's a Wonderful Life will even stick around? Maybe that will eventually fall out of estimation again, and people will stop talking about it a second time.
Again, there's so much art created all the time, and only so much of it gets remembered, at least in the mainstream. This is why we have critics and historians and scholars. You know, they're there to actually keep track of everything because everyone else has other stuff to do. We don't have time to read every book ever written. We don't have time to listen to every record ever recorded. But there are people out there who are trying to do that, and sometimes we shout out and say, hey, no, wait, this one's a good one. Don't forget this one. It's really important. That's something I take very seriously as a film critic. All of this is true. And the other thing that's important to remember is that there are factors that we cannot predict that will have an impact whether you realize it or not. Think about movies that have small roles from people who became famous a long time later. In an episode of The Iron List not too long ago, I talked about a film called The Lavender Hill Mob. And in The Lavender Hill Mob, it was for cameos, actually. Best cameos ever. Lavender Hill Mob begins with a character played by Peter Sellers. No, wait, Al Guinness. Played by Al Guinness.
Al Guinness, yeah.
It is Al Guinness, yeah. And The idea is he's giving an interview and he's extremely wealthy and popular. And while he's like giving the interview, people interrupt him and say, "Hey, thank you for loaning me that money. It really changed my life." And he's like, "No problem." And then Audrey Hepburn walks up to him and says basically the equivalent of, "Last night was the greatest night of my life." And then she kisses him and then she walks away. And it's like, holy shit, he knows Audrey Hepburn. He's dating Audrey Hepburn. And then here's the thing. Audrey Hepburn wasn't famous when that movie was made. The original joke was she was just a pretty girl, and this guy had gotten a pretty girl interested in him. Now you look back, oh my God, it's Audrey Hepburn. So context changes dramatically. I was also thinking about, and this is a much sadder context, there was a time not terribly long ago, maybe 10 years ago, where if you brought up the movie Dirty Dancing, there was very often a moment where people had to remember, oh yeah, wasn't there like a subplot about abortion in that movie? And
yes.
Now, you know, a few years later, it's like, yeah, no, that's kind of the most important part of the movie. And it's weird that we ever thought it wasn't, some of us, you know, because times have changed and we're now looking back at movies that had, you know, messages about abortion that may not have hit as hard back when everyone had access to it.
Yeah.
You know, so that movie is a movie that whose power I think has shifted from it had become kind of a slumber party movie to becoming, I think, a bit more noteworthy and respected as a political film.
Yeah.
So you just never know. You never know exactly how it's going to shake out. And sometimes it's for the worse. But but that's a great point. And I the long and short of it is we shouldn't write off any movie, even if we dislike it, because maybe we're wrong or maybe we're right. Yeah, and it's still just really popular and it has a big impact.
It's popular. It's a big impact. But, you know, I think as critics, we're still within our rights to say, oh, well, that's a piece of crap.
Yeah,
there are some
right.
films that I've tried to reappraise and still find them completely repellent. Space Jam is still one of the worst of all time. Yes.
Yeah, sorry. I did an article. I was very ambitious. I was like, I'm going to write an article about, it was like, I think it was like the 20th anniversary of Ballistic X versus Sever,
which is
considered one of the worst movies ever made. And I was like, hey, listen, I haven't seen this movie. I never saw it. So I want to watch it with fresh eyes. And maybe, you know, there's a thin chance I'll find out it's actually a classic. Maybe at the very least I can say, you know, with the benefit of hindsight, when all the word of mouth has died down, maybe we can just say it's an okay action movie. No, that one sucks. That's an extremely incompetent
they just
movie.
continue to suck.
That's just a really
deep
bad
into history.
Film. Yeah. Anyway, we should move on.
This next letter comes from Adam. Adam. Hello, Adam.
Hi, Adam.
Adam says, "Hi, I've been listening since the B-Movies podcast days." Oh my gosh, you're devoted. "You two are like the film friends I never had." I grew up in a small conservative religious town, and movies were my way out. I did not know it at the time, but a lot of the ideas I was presented with were poisonous, and film showed me that there were other ways of thinking of being out there. So thank you for personifying the film community I never had." That's the glories of the internet, isn't it?
That's an honor, thank you.
"And now... my favorite films of the last 25 years."
Ooh.
"In no particular order." Yeah, this is based on a podcast we did recently. We did that, the best film since the year 2000.
Yeah.
Here they are. First Cow. Oh, what a good choice.
Yes.
Kelly Reichardt's great power is empathy. Her great skill is character. She used those to actually make me feel joy, at least for a little while. Mulholland Drive. A truly mind-blowing experience when I first saw it in grade 9. Oh, golly, when you're 14, is that a movie? And unlike other films that also blew my mind back then, it has continued to baffle and delight me. Spirited Away. We could likely all stand to spend some time learning the value of washing floors, enjoying a well-earned meal, and caring for others. That is a theme of Spirited Away, like the sort of the value of labor. It's kind of a weird theme for it, because the main character is a child.
And she's forced into it, too. But the movie has a lot of complicated ideas about that,
Zodiac. Good choice. Competence porn, where everyone is incompetent. A procedural where the procedure doesn't work.
I love that. That's a great way to describe that movie.
Speed Racer, the greatest feat of visual storytelling of the last 25 years. Mad Max Fury Road, I guess tied for the greatest visual storytelling of the last 25 years. The Master. Oh, that's a good one, The Master.
Great pick.
Religion, sexual repression, and fractured expression and power. This is a great statement about masculinity in the last quarter century. Inside Llewyn Davis, a broken, awful person making beautiful art. I don't think he's an awful person. I think he's struggling.
He's not a great person, but no, I wouldn't necessarily say he's awful.
Let's see. The Grand Budapest Hotel, the most beautiful visions of brokenness and humanity. It has only become more important as our world steers into the insanity. The Handmaiden, ooh, good choice. A twisty, sexy, eat-the-rich fable with impeccable performances and tone. And Twin Peaks, The Return. I know it's TV, but it's my actual favorite filmed thing. Well, you know what? You're not alone. Cahiers du Cinéma, I think, listed Twin Peaks, The Return as the best film of the year that year it came out.
It did. It was a bold choice. And here's the thing. Regardless of whether it's TV or a film, if you want to make that distinction, they're the same visual language, aren't they? Lynch is working in the same space. I'm totally fine with it.
Yeah. And then there's some runners-up. Edward Yang's Yi Yi, A 1 and a 2, American Psycho, Gosford Park, Ocean's 11, A Mighty Wind.
Oh, this is a good one.
A Scanner Darkly. That's interesting.
I like that film a lot.
Yeah, Synecdoche, New York. A lot of people like
Synecdoche, New York.
I don't know this film, World of Tomorrow.
Oh, no, that's Don Hertzfeldt.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I didn't see World of Tomorrow.
Yeah, it's a hell of a film.
The Don Hertzfeldt movie.
Yeah.
Also Killers of the Flower Moon and Winter's Bone.
Winter's Bone is a great movie. I know you do, but Winter's Bone is a great movie, and people do. I feel like that movie has been reduced to like trivia. Like that was Jennifer Lawrence's first Oscar nomination, but Winter's Bone kicks ass. That's a great mystery film. You know,
Ozark noir, they say.
Yeah, I would have loved to have seen a sequel to that.
Yeah, that would have been great. Anyway, it says all the best, Adam.
Adam, thank you so much for contributing, and great picks, all around. I think it's interesting that there's a few favorites that pop up on a lot of these lists, films like Zodiac, for example. But it's always fun to just see what connects to different people, you know?
Yeah, for sure. I like the description of Zodiac as a procedural about a broken procedure. I think that's really great.
And competence porn about incompetent people. That's a great bit. Yeah. That's a great line. You should write that. I'm glad you did write that down. You should publish that as well. Right. Yeah.
Anyway, here is another letter along the same lines from Wynn. Hello, Wynn.
Hi, Wynn.
It says, hi, Bibbs and Rocky. Oh, that's me. I'm Rocky.
Yeah.
Oh, Rocky. I was thinking of my list of the best movies of the century.
Rocky. I don't know Rocky and Bullwinkle enough.
You can't do Bullwinkle?
I can do it.
He's above his head.
I don't know what he'd say is the problem. Yeah. I know what Rocky would say. Like, here's something you'll really like. But you're Rocky in this situation.
Really
so
like. I'm Rocky.
I'd be Bibbswinkle.
I'll still be Rocky. Okay. Our listener writes in, I was thinking of my list of the best movies of the century, and since I have weird taste and can't defend most of it, I'm going to have movies and have interesting reasons and not putting them in any order.
Okay, I love it.
Number one, The Fandom. This is about furry fandom and how weird and queer it is. Made by a trans furry YouTuber. This movie is also on my top 10 documentaries and top 10 queer movies. I don't know this movie.
I don't know this one at all. That's awesome. Thank you for letting me know about this movie.
The fandom about furries. Okay. Huh. Number two, Inside Out. Therapists took one look at this movie and said, OMG, my job just got easier. Having a way to explain emotions to children is so important and great. I mean, it really is.
Yeah.
It's like... I like the memes that were going around. Like, Pixar says, what if your toys have feelings? Then they said, what if your closet monster have feelings? And finally they just said, heck, what if your feelings had feelings?
Yeah.
And yeah, they kind of nailed that one. I love Inside Out.
But it does. It does give you, I think, a useful vernacular to think about your feelings. I mean, there's an entire school of thought in therapy, and I'm not a therapist. I'm not going to go into a big spiel about it, called, like, parts work, where instead of taking everything as something that's all-consuming, I am depressed, I am angry, there's a part of me that is, you know? And that's Inside Out. All in a nutshell, isn't it? This thing is really interesting. But Inside Out's a pretty damn great movie. Yeah.
Number three, This Is Not a Film. It's the most badass movie of all time. He snuck the film into TIFF in a cake. Jafar Panahi has been banned from filmmaking and has made 10 films since then.
God bless that dude. I still haven't even seen this one, but my God. Like, what a hero.
You saw No Bears, right?
No, I missed that one too.
Oh, yeah. Go see No Bears. That one's really fantastic.
Noted.
Number four, The Love Witch. Anna Biller made this movie. Director, producer, composer, writer, costume designer. She probably made the cupcakes. This is a celebration of power of femininity when most of the time for female characters to be powerful, they have to be masculine. Number five, Spirited Away. American animation would never dare to be this interesting and creative. Another Spirited Away.
Fair enough.
Which I can't. I mean, that's unassailable. I can't really fault people for listing Spirited Away.
No, it's great.
And then here are a few I like for personal reasons. Doctor Who, The Waters of Mars.
Oh, that's cool.
But Doctor Who is there.
And it's got a killer ending, man. The ending of Waters of Mars is a hell of a thing.
Battle of the Sexes. It's the tennis movie.
Yeah.
I was closeted and depressed, and this was the movie that made me want to come out.
Oh, wow. Yay!
If it hits you personally, welcome out. You are.
That's what we're talking about. You never know what the movie is that's going to change your life. You never know.
Yeah, good.
That's amazing. But the filmmakers would love to hear that.
Coraline. Childhood fairy tale fear is deep and constant. Puss in Boots, The Last Wish. Cat Zorro versus Death. What's the rest of the movie about again?
I really need to see that one again, because I was one of the few critics who didn't love that movie. Like, I appreciated what it was doing visually that was novel that so many movies have taken from since. So it's already historically significant, but yeah, I wasn't a huge fan of the actual film. Maybe I got caught up in all the things everyone else is just not really thinking about. I really do need to watch this one again one of these days.
And finally, Zootopia. Furry movie is furry. Also, they announced Disney Plus, and I thought Cop Show, Paw and Order, ZPD. Signed, win.
That's cool. Zootopia really snuck up on us. It was like one of those Disney movies that they clearly didn't believe in that much, and then accidentally became their biggest movie of the year. It's a good flick. It's a good flick. It's one of those ones where, not unlike Pixar's Cars, I get caught up in the weeds of how this world makes sense.
Well, what I found a little bit odd, because Zootopia came out the same year as that movie Sing, if I recall, or they were kind of close to each other.
Either Sing came out that Christmas and Zootopia came out March, or it was the same year, yeah.
Yeah, and what I found really curious is both Sing and Zootopia were based on this really curious premise: what if animals were kind of like people? It's like, so, like, every cartoon? It's like... Like, that was, all of a sudden, like, having anthropomorphic animals was, like, a big selling point. It's like, dude, I've been watching that since I was born.
Like,
What are we doing here?
I can't speak for Sing, but when it comes to Zootopia, the idea of Zootopia wasn't just anthropomorphic animals. The idea is, what if a society consisting of a wide variety of anthropomorphic animals was the same as living in any one of, for example, America's larger melting pots? Which really is more of a stew pot. You know, people don't necessarily like congeal all their cultures together. There's still big clumps, but like, you know, like New York City or Los Angeles or Chicago or whatever. But like, how would that like sort of function? Basically, it's like, let's take the basic idea that we take for granted and let's think it out as if we'd never thought it out before.
Yeah.
And that, I think, is always a good idea. I think about this a lot when I think about institutions we take for granted. Like, it's a side thing. It's not the same as Zootopia. But, for example, imagine if someone suggested today, for the very first time, what if we had awards for movies? Now, again, we don't have any history of it. Do we really think all of the awards at the Academy Awards would be the same? I do not think so. There are certain things that would be similar. We certainly have an award for Best Picture, probably. But would we only have one award for Best Picture? Would we have an award for Best Picture divided by genre? Would we have gendered acting categories? Why would we limit ourselves to 5 nominees? Would we have a different number of nominees? Would adapted screenplay be considered significantly different today? Would we have a different category just for like animated acting as opposed to live action acting? I don't know why I said animated like that. But I just think that we take these things for granted because they've been with us for so long. But when you just take an idea and just like, hey, let's erase all the context and just look at the idea and imagine if we came up with that idea now. That's what Zootopia is when it comes to anthropomorphic animals. And I think, you know, for all the movie's flaws, I don't think it's you know, I think there's some weird stuff in that movie that I get really hung up on. It's neat. It works pretty good.
Okay, fair enough. Yeah. I still thought it was a little curious, but all right.
And it is. I just think that's why it works. I think that's why people are treating it like it's different, because the filmmakers treated it like it was different. You know?
Yeah, fair.
Yeah.
Anyway, here's another letter. This one comes from Lauren. Hello, Lauren.
Hi, Lauren.
Hello, Bibbs and Whitney McCool.
Yeah.
You've opened the door to the best films of the 21st century emails, and since I was working on my list anyway, I'll spare you the top 100 that I'm writing up and just give you the top 10. Here you go.
Okay.
Before I jump into the list, though, I want to send out a special thank you to Bibbs. As a trans person who is finding it harder and harder to exist online lately, seeing your name as the reposter for countless pro-trans rights blue sky posts has made everything feel a little less scary.
Oh, well, anyway, thank you.
I'm glad here's my list.
Okay.
Yeah, look, we are pro everybody's rights. We want people to have rights and not have rights. So yeah, we're gonna repost.
And I think it's especially important right now that we stand up for the rights of people who are basically being attacked.
For no good reason. Yeah.
And that includes trans people, that includes immigrants of all varieties. This is people all over the world. It's a nightmare out of there for a lot of people, and we really need to do every single thing that we can about it, even if we don't feel like we can do enough. So I will try to do more, but thank you for I'm glad that's been of some comfort. Thank you.
Anyway, on to the list. Number 10, I guess counting down from 10. Number 10 is Personal Shopper, Olivier Assayas.
Yeah.
While either of the Assayas Kristen Stewart pairings could have made this list, Personal Shopper spoke to me a little more than the clouds of Sils Maria. The ghost story lives by the performance from Stewart, who at the time was still trying to gain the respect she deserved after the Twilight films. Haunted by the death of her brother after living a meaningless life attached to the world of the wealthy, Personal Shopper was an invigorating watch from the best actress of my generation. She is so good.
She's amazing in that movie. And that movie actually has one of my favorite scary scenes in a movie from this century so far. And if you've never seen it, I'm not going to.
Is this where she goes into? She has a phone and she goes into a tunnel? Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. It's like her phone is inaccessible, and then when it turns on, there's a whole thing. And it scared the living daylights out of me. Like, it was just such a brilliant horror gag. I couldn't believe I hadn't seen it done that, at least done that way before. Really just incredible.
That's a really good one. Number 9, There Will Be Blood. Some, if not many, of the entries on my list may seem a little cliche, but who am I to argue with canon? Daniel D. Lewis in There Will Be Blood is my vote for second greatest acting performance of the century. Number 1 will be appearing next on the list. Through Anderson and Daniel D. Lewis, Daniel Plainview so perfectly captures the American id in a way that has become only more poignant as greed's control over our world has grown. Between There Will Be Blood, The Master, and
Phantom Thread?
You could argue Phantom Thread. There was sort of like a portrait of America, I think, that Paul Thomas Anderson was trying to sort of put together in this epic kind of a way. My wife who had a really great interpretation of Paul Thomas Anderson's first 8 films. She pointed out that they were the 7 Deadly Sins. And how There Will Be Blood was clearly greed. Well, heart eight, because one is called Heart Eight, and that's the eighth one, you see. So, but the seven that came after that were the seven deadly sins.
Got it. Okay, that makes sense.
Because Boogie Nights is lust, Inherent Vice is sloth, et cetera, et cetera. Let's see. Number eight is Jackie, Pablo Larraín film. With all respect to Daniel Day-Lewis, Natalie Portman's performance as Jacqueline Kennedy Onassis is the greatest that this young century has delivered. Portman delivers the shock Jackie experienced in the wake of her husband's untimely death, with the obsession over legacy that had to be executed in an extremely calculated way. Something as simple as her walking through the cemetery, heels sinking into the wet ground in search of the perfect plot for Jack, where he had to be buried, lives inside me as a perfect moment in cinema. That one didn't hit me as hard. The Pablo Larraín films don't hit me as hard as I think a lot of critics, but
I think Natalie Portman
was the good part. Yeah.
I feel like Jackie and Spencer worked really well for me, because I think they were approaching history through the lens of women who, you know, their stories have been told, but they're not the stories everyone like defaults to. And I'm particularly a huge fan of Spencer. I think Spencer is just uncanny. And Jackie is a film. I like the film. I love Natalie Portman's performance. I do agree. She's amazing in it.
Yeah. Number seven, Mulholland Drive. There it is again. This film would likely have made my list had I sent it to you a month ago, but due to the passing of Lynch earlier this year, I was lucky enough to catch this in IMAX. And because of that, it's clear that this film deserves to be here. When a director is singular enough that their name becomes an adjective, that tells you all you need to know. That they all do something special, and Lynch or Lynchian is part of an illustrious group. I don't really know how to talk about Mulholland Drive, as it's a transformation from a TV pilot into a feature film and leaves much to be unexplained, but it is an experience that consumes me every time I rewatch it.
All right, I have a new goal in life.
What's your new goal?
I need to come up with such a weird way to do film criticism that it can be called Bibbianian. Bibbianian film criticism. Like, what would that be? I feel like, you ever see Pollock with Ed Harris?
I did not see Pollock.
Okay, so Jackson Pollock, famous painter, and the style he's most famous for is like this sort of drip painting, which is half skill, half chaos. And there's a moment in Pollock, because he's been like trying to do something important. He's been trying to do something original and interesting with his career. And he starts doing the dripping thing. And then I forget if Marcia Gay Harden plays, if she's his wife at the time, but she just walks in and just says, "You cracked it." And I'm like, I just want that with film criticism. I don't know what it is. It's like I figured out something to replace a star system, and like, we did it. That's my place in history. That's so Bibbianian.
You just need to write in such an iconoclastic style that it couldn't be mistaken for anybody else.
I'm working on that. I'm working on that real hard. Anyway, but then my editors get involved. Okay, moving on.
Oh, those editors, those helpful editors.
Yes.
Anyway, number six, Her, by Spike Jonze. This film consumed my life for over a decade now, and it's easily the film I'm proselytizing the most for in my life. The near-future science fiction film captures a loneliness that has consumed me the majority of my life in a way that no other film has, and while my dozens of watches, I've never escaped viewing without crying.
Wow.
I feel like the film captures a level of hope that I believe is important to the film's success. Her's premise was a dangerous one to run with, and if the awful film Jexy taught us anything. But Jones' respect for the situation and the perfect encapsulation of the character by Joaquin Phoenix resulted in something magical. The Arcade Fire score is also a long favorite of mine, and I was very excited when it was released on vinyl some 8 years after the film came out.
It was Arcade Fire. I forgot about that.
Yeah. I feel like watching Her, in this particular year when so many businesses are leaning so hard into AI, now will strike a little bit of a note of ambivalence.
You think?
The AI might not be seen as wholly sympathetic. Not that Samantha, the artificial intelligence, is at all sinister in that movie. In fact, she's very sort of warm and affectionate. But our relationship and our attachment to this artificial thing might be seen as a little bit scary and unhealthy, even though in the movie it presents it as very natural.
Well, the movie presents it as well, I think the movie presents it as new and different and worthy of skepticism for a lot of it. And when I watch her, I'm torn by, you know, this guy is getting something profound out of this, but is it one-sided, is the question. So, but this is a great example, though, of a movie that, you know, this movie won an Oscar. A movie won an Oscar for Best Screenplay. It was a critical success. I think it made money. It's a big movie by any reasonable estimation. And it's over 10 years now since it came out. And the context around its subject matter has changed a lot. I think you can probably watch her right now and see a brilliant movie, but will you see the same movie you saw when it came out? I don't think you will, and I certainly don't think people who watch it for the first time will, because their relationship with the technology that they were kind of inventing for that film is very, very different. So that's actually a good illustration of what we were talking about earlier. Yeah.
There you are. Number five on this list is In the Mood for Love, Wong Kar-wai. I'm not sure if a more sensual film has ever been created. Beautiful colors and near constant soft focus. In the Mood for Love is the perfect encapsulation of yearning. It's almost as if the David Lean film Brief Encounter cocooned itself for 55 years before emerging as the butterfly of tempestuous passion, so all-consuming that the rest of the world ceases to exist.
Okay, I love this movie. I know you're not as big a fan.
I don't like In the Mood for Love. It's so weird.
It should be up your alley. But I will say this. I will say this right now, because we've talked, whenever we talk about In the Mood for Love, there's something that comes up. And I'm very serious about this. And so when the opportunity arises, I want to take advantage of this, because I established this rule.
Okay.
Achingly.
Uh-huh.
You're only allowed to use the word achingly in reference to In the Mood for Love. That's the only movie where we allow that adjective anymore. So I just want to say that movie is achingly good, because I can't say it at any other time.
Achingly. There is a lot of aching. There's so much aching. I wish they did something about it.
Hey.
This movie about these two people who are sitting across from each other, and they just yearn. They just yearn to be together. Fuck it. Just fuck. It's okay. You can do something about it. They're right there. I mean, there's no... Anyway, I get really frustrated with that movie. It's like a perfume ad for me, but I know that just makes me a Philistine. Number four is After Sun by Charlotte Wells. I'm not one to elevate a film to a classic that quickly. I believe that you have to live with something for an extended period of time before it becomes an unshakable part of you. That's why the second newest film on this list is from 2017. But After Sun is such a perfect piece of art that in less than 3 years, I'm comfortable calling it a masterwork and having it stand with these cinematic giants. What makes After Sun so special is the underlying emotionality of the film. What may look like just home movies of a father-daughter trip to a Turkish resort takes on a much deeper meaning because of the implications of the present. It's like this is the last time that these two main characters ever saw each other, and witnessing their personal, mostly but not completely hidden feelings feels like prying into things which should never be shared. It is a supernatural film. The story and the emotions really gradually unfold themselves in really tactile ways. That's something I really like about After Sun.
And the supernatural elements really don't call attention to themselves very much. Like, you have to watch it like 5 times before you realize there's even a vampire in it.
Wait, what?
Well, you said it was supernatural.
Supernatural?
You said it was supernatural.
You're just making a funny.
I am making a funny. I will say this about what you were saying about After Sun, about how is it too soon to call something a classic? And again, these things can change over time, and that's fine. I'm of the belief that while you shouldn't be, like, quick to label something that's brand new, like an all-timer, I also believe that the reason we don't rush to that is not because it can't happen. It's because so that when it does happen, we can get taken seriously. Because if you say, yes, like 20 movies a year are some of the best movies ever made, you're going to look like someone who is easy to be, it's easy to win you over.
Yeah. Well, but also, there's the whole,
yeah,
there's the whole deal with recency bias. The ones you remember best are the ones, yeah, you just saw, are the ones that you're going to be more prone to call some of the best of the year. I think I did that with my list. I think I listed, yeah, more recent films than films from earlier in the decade.
I think I did too, but and that may be a factor. But I will say this, I also believe very, very truly that there are times when you see a new movie and you go, no, that is an all-timer. And if you don't say that all the time, it means something. I'm reminded of like when like Siskel and Ebert went like all in on Hoop Dreams.
Uh-huh.
Like they didn't just say that was a good movie. They said that was one of the best movies, like right when it came out. And it mattered because they didn't usually go gaga over a film like that. And that was a film, uh-huh, that went from being like pretty well respected to a film that was considered like a must see film when it came out. Specifically, yeah, because Ebert and Siskel saved it. They reserved their praise for when it really counted. And that made all the difference in the world, I think, at that time.
Yeah. All right. Next on this list is Lost in Translation, Sofia Coppola. While not officially confirmed, it's likely that the divorce between Sofia Coppola and Spike Jonze resulted in two films that I consider to be in the top 10 of the century thus far. A pretty clear theme to my list is that films can capture loneliness, especially with a dash of hope, speaks to me on a visceral level. Bill Murray and Scarlett Johansson, who appears in both the Coppola and Jones divorce films, embody a loneliness that comes with a complacency to who find what they need to survive in themselves. I feel like Lost in Translation underwent a bit of a relitigation in recent years. A lot, mm-hmm, of Asian critics were pointing out that it was made by a white director who treated Japanese culture as sort of like an other culture. It othered, mm-hmm, the Asian characters. And it was about these two white characters sort of lost in this far away exotic place of Japan, you know, heavily, yeah, populated city.
Yeah.
And I feel like when that happened, we did lose sight of that sort of loneliness that it is actually very expert in capturing. So there, it's okay, mm-hmm, to feel a little bit ambivalent about this one because it does other Asian cultures, but, right, at the same time, it is incredibly sensitive and emotionally beautiful about the plight of the main characters.
You know, I think there's something about Lost in Translation that, you know, maybe could have mitigated that a little bit, where we never see America, mm-hmm, in that movie. We don't see where they come from, so that when they go to when there's a change of scenery, whether it's Japan or the Ozarks or wherever, it makes a difference. I'm reminded of the director's cut of James Cameron's Avatar, which adds at least one scene, maybe two, on Earth. So you see what a shithole it became. So that when he goes, wow, to Pandora, you're like, oh, I get it. No, I get it. Because when Pandora is your only sense of context in the movie, that's the only world in that world. And I'm not saying it's, yeah, not pretty, but like we get used to it after a while. We're unaware that to these characters, or we're not feeling the awareness that these characters would have of how different it is. And so, yeah, there is something that it feels somewhat disconnected from its sense of people who are out of place, uh-huh, because we only see them out of place. And, yeah, as a result, I think it's easy to infer a lot of negative things. And honestly, I don't want to give Sofia Coppola too much credit. I haven't really heard her speak to this. Maybe she just whiffed it. Maybe she wasn't thinking about that. And that was a problem that isn't just, maybe it's a feature and not a bug. You know, I've made that mistake, yeah, before. I thought, oh, this is just a problem with that film, but otherwise it's good. And then I find out the filmmaker like actually truly loves that part. And I think that's the important part. And I was way off and I gave, yeah, him too much credit. But it's a film that I think is also, you know, with the benefit of different voices being heard about it, the context is changing. But you're right. The sense of loneliness of its characters is powerful. Yeah. And it's very difficult to write that off, even if there are other parts of the movie that don't work for you.
There's two more films on this list. Number two is WALL-E.
Yeah, great movie.
It seems like a token Pixar film is customary on these lists. And for me, there is no question that WALL-E is the choice. I strongly believe that the first act of this film is perfect cinema, and while the film does drop in quality a little when Wally and Eve make it to the Axiom, the film is still unimpeachable, and the Define dancing scene makes me tear up every time. Yeah, I also especially love that the film plays respect to classic cinema, especially in that the character of Wally is a direct homage to Charlie Chaplin's The Tramp, and that reverence to a bit of cinematic history that doesn't appear much in the current movie landscape brings me joy. I like Wally. I agree I feel like it's stronger before Wally leaves Earth. By the time after Wally leaves Earth, it becomes a little bit more of like an adventure film. And then it becomes like insufferably hopeful. And who wants hope in movies? Good God.
There are a lot of movies when people say like, oh, I like it up to a point and then it changes. I often find myself really liking the second half of it. That's like, I like, hear me out here. The rest of Up. Like, I actually like the rest of Up.
Dogs and the bird and the Zeppelin. All of that stuff is fun. Yeah.
If the movie wasn't so front loaded emotionally, I think we would look back on that movie and go, that was a cute movie with the flying dogs and stuff. I like that movie. Mm-hmm. But instead, they did one part of the movie too well. Almost like it's almost them screwing up because they just couldn't cash that check throughout the entire process. I like all of Wally. Who likes
I like Wally. Okay. I like the first part of Wally really go. Yeah. I'm the weirdo who likes the second half of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome better than the Thunderdome stuff.
Yeah. See that's a road you walk alone. I cannot join you on that journey.
Well, I don't understand what would make somebody want to build a Thunderdome. I don't know why they have a Thunderdome. The only way I can explain it is cocaine made its way into the post-apocalypse. They just, doing lines of coke and inventing Thunderdomes.
It's
their
an
spare
entire
time.
Civilization that is literally huffing methane all day, every day. Of course, there's a Thunderdome.
It just makes me like humanity less. It's like humanity is on the brink of extinction. Can we hurry it along, please?
Winnie, I'm just going to say that. Anyway. I'm going to say this right now. I've said it before, and I'll say it again. You really need to get beyond Thunderdome.
I'm going to get beyond Thunderdome.
Can we get beyond
Thunderdome? Number one on this list.
Yes.
Number one on this list is Werkmeister Harmonies, the Bélotar film.
Wow.
I, like Whitney, am a fan of bleak cinema. The 21st century started with one of the best in the genre. Werkmeister Harmonies was my introduction to Bélotar, and even watching it on a crappy bootleg DVD on a tiny TV, the opening scene moved me in a way that nothing else has. Janosch's innocence and sincerity in a world that's collapsing around him is the perfect audience surrogate. The film is largely devoid of non-diegetic sound, but this ends up working perfectly, as every time that Malahi Vig's emotionally devastating theme appears, the depth of emotion sets into me, leaving me raw in Tar's hands. The best film of the century thus far. Signed, Lauren.
Lauren,
that's a great list. And capping it off with Bélotar is pretty bold.
I want to say something right now, and I don't think I get to say this enough, or at least I don't take the opportunity to enough. Uh-huh. Our listeners and the critically acclaimed network, and if you're listening, this is you. I love our listeners because within like 1 week we can get genuine, and I don't mean like complainy complaints, but like genuine real critiques. Hey, you guys didn't talk about Thunderbolts enough. And that was a fair point. We actually spent most of our Thunderbolts review not talking about Thunderbolts. But like there was an actual critique. You guys don't talk about Thunderbolts enough. That's part of our fan base. Also, you know what's the best movie of the century so far? Werkmeister Harmonies. That's the same fan base. That is an amazing group of people we've got listening to us right now. So if you're listening to us right now and you're not driving, like if it's not dangerous, I want you to literally pat yourself on the back right now. Because you're very cool. You are very
cool
people.
You're a cool crowd with interesting taste.
Very much so.
And we love every bit of it. If you are here in Los Angeles and you're listening to this before the first week of June 2025, go down to the American Cinematheque at the Arrow or at the Los Feliz or at the Egyptian. They're having Bleak Week, Cinema of Despair, Year 3. I intend to go. I'm finally going to see Come and See. I really, really want to see some of these depressing-ass movies. They sound amazing.
Actually, that reminds me, because I keep forgetting to mention this, but speaking of the Egyptian, if you want to go down to the Egyptian Theater on, is it on Hollywood or Sunset? It's on Sunset, right?
The Egyptian's on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah, on Hollywood. Okay, those things are parallel and they're very close. If you want to go to the Egyptian Theater on Memorial Day, May 26th, at I think about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, there is a screening of Jaws that I will be introducing.
Hey, look at you.
So I will be standing up in front of people and I will be giving my thoughts on Jaws. I'm not going to take up too much of your time. We're here to watch Jaws. But I will be there if anyone wants to stop by. And I think that's very, very cool. And I keep forgetting to mention this, and I really, really need to, because this might be my last chance before the actual date. So yeah, if you're in LA and you want to, and you want to stop by, please do.
All right. Here's another letter. This one comes from Louise. It's just called A Quick Question. Mm-hmm. Hello, chaps. What's your favorite TV show theme song or movie tie-in song that helpfully explains the premise of the movie/show? Enjoyed the first newsletter. Keep up the good work. Regards, Louise. Well, I mean, the golden standard for this, there's two, and they were both co-written by Sherwood Schwartz. One of them is The Ballad of Gilligan's Island. The other one is the Brady Bunch theme song.
I mean, those two are gold standards. Yeah.
Yeah, are the high watermark, because not only do they explain the premise of the show and all of the characters, but they're both earworms that stick in your head and you can re-sing them like after only hearing them twice. The original, I'm not sure if you've seen the original pilot episode theme song for Gilligan's Island.
I haven't.
There was a Calypso theme song that explained the premise that was written by John Williams. It was an early score of his.
Really?
And they rejected it because it wasn't good enough. And then Sherwood Schwartz sat down with some other music writers, came up with the sea shanty that we have today.
Yeah.
Terms of, like, movie themes that sort of explain the premise, I think, unfortunately, we're well past the era of the over-credits rap song about things that just happened in the movie. I do like Partners in Crime's T-U-R-T-L-E Power.
I was just about to say that. I was literally just looking up who did T-U-R-T-L-E Power. Because that is seriously one of the best movie theme songs ever. If you haven't seen the original live-action Teenage Ninja Turtles movie, or if you have, but it's been a long time, or you haven't really listened to the soundtrack, you look up Partners in Crimes, T-U-R-T-L-E Power. And I defy you not to just marvel at it. It is such an incredibly great, like, just here's everything about the movie in a nutshell. And it's like, it's a little cooler than it needs to be.
Yeah. That's what I like about it. It's really kind of hummable, but something else really fun about the Partners in Crime song is that it gets some details wrong.
Yeah.
Like it was written after an earlier draft, or it was looking at its phone while it was watching Ninja Turtles, so it didn't quite observe everything. And the fourth one is Raphael. He's the leader of the group. Actually, he isn't the leader of the group.
And he never was. Everybody knows it's not even Leonardo in the comics. Leads. Yeah, that's weird. Yeah. I forgot about that. You're right. I have a personal favorite theme song. Well, I have two favorite theme songs when it comes to explaining the entire premise. One, fans of our programs should probably be familiar with is My Mother the Car. Everybody knows in the second life we all come back sooner or later. And if you want to hear the ultimate version of that, Sammy Davis Jr. covered that song.
That's right.
Davis Jr., one of the greatest entertainers of the 20th century, and I would argue ever, sang a kick-ass version of a song about what happens when your mom is reincarnated as a car. And it's yep. it's great. But when it comes to another TV show, this is one that, you know, I think it had a cult, and maybe it still does, but it's kind of died down. But I really do think that one of the last great old-fashioned TV theme songs was Jack of All Trades.
Okay.
In 1801, the revolution had been won, and Uncle Sam's favorite son had a job he needed done, which brought Jack to a lady, both beautiful and smart, who found his mix intriguing, a scoundrel with a heart. From the halls of Montezuma to the shores of Tripoli, there was never a leatherneck braver, a daring dragoon was he. He'll halt the bold advance of Napoleon's attack. There ain't a French or pirate rogue who don't know Jack. That's a great fucking song. That's a great fucking song. If you've never seen Jack of All Trades, it's like Remington Steele. If instead of Pierce Brosnan pretending to be a great private detective, it's Bruce Campbell pretending to be basically Zorro. And it's a delight. So there you go. That's that. But when it comes to movies, yeah, T-U-R-T-L-E Power is still number one.
Yeah.
With a bullet.
Let's see. I guess we have time for another letter. What do you think?
We have time for one or two more, yeah.
All right. So this one comes from Eric, and this is a drinking game.
Ooh.
Eric says, "Dear Bib Six and Rock Commodore McCool."
Ooh.
So I think Bib Six is a reference to Tuvix, perhaps. In a recent episode of All Our Yesterdays, you mused how the coverage of Star Trek in All Our Yesterdays affected by the critically acclaimed drinking game, so I will humbly submit. These are the rules for the All Our Yesterdays post-TOS expansion pack of the critically acclaimed drinking game.
Okay.
Rules are in addition...
Oh, real fast. Yes? If anyone is listening and doesn't know what we're talking about, over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, Whitney and I have a podcast that's exclusive for some of our patrons. It's at a certain tier where we have been reviewing every single episode of Star Trek in order. We are hundreds of episodes in at this point. And I yeah. feel like after that much time, we've found a groove. There are certainly things that we do or say or complain about a lot. So I was sure, surely someone could come up with a great drinking game. So let's hear it.
All right. So these are the rules for the All Our Yesterdays post-TOS expansion pack of the critically acclaimed drinking game. These rules are in addition to the regular gameplay and are not meant as replacements. All previous rules, e.g. Futurama references or Whitney's dislike of Blade Runner, are still in play. at the start of each round, the player takes one drink. This is to fulfill the rule of the main drinking game, where you take a drink for a Star Trek discussion in a regular episode. One drink, no start date. The phrase colossal negative space wedgie.
Okay.
Whitney's fan fiction. Tuvix.
Yes.
Data has emotions.
Yes.
Or Bibbs says, the Argo.
We'll take the Argo.
We'll take the Argo.
I haven't said that in a while, actually. I need to bring it back.
Take two drinks. If we mention Peter David, nice. We talk about Lower Decks.
Yes.
If Whitney imitates Captain Janeway. If Bibbs mentioned that he watched DS9 in 1 week. Or the discussion switches to another episode because this episode is boring.
Whitney, could you do me a favor? Could you tell me there's coffee in that nebula?
There's coffee in that nebula.
Yes!
Get off my bridge.
Two drinks.
Take three drinks if a female character is being underused.
Yes.
If Tasha was done dirty.
Yes.
Or if Whitney mentions Gilligan's Island.
Wait, I have to know if Gilligan's Planet counts. Do you think Gilligan's Planet counts?
I would say Gilligan's Planet counts.
Okay, just check.
And let's see. Finish your entire can or your entire drink if moral, ethical, or sexual ramifications of a holodeck or holosuite is mentioned. This is played once in holodeck-centric episodes or else you'll die.
Yes,
so
that's true.
We can't mention it. Don't finish your drink if we mention it repeatedly.
If it's a holodeck episode, and, it's going to come up a lot, yeah.
And shout, computer end program. If Whitney compliments Trump, you're in a malfunctioning holodeck program. Live long and prosper, Eric. Well, those are some good ones.
I love it. That's true. And lately, since we always begin an All Our Yesterdays podcast with the star date, which is usually given at the beginning of every episode of Star Trek. But as we have discovered, and which we had totally forgotten about, a lot of the time on Star Trek Deep Space Nine, they don't do that. And it has thrown off our entire routine. To the extent that when we say, we open with like stardate unknown, and there's this like, there's a sense of genuine disappointment in the air that needs to be addressed. And I think eventually we'll get used to it, but it's still weird right now.
Yeah.
You know? So anyway, that is a great drinking game. I love it. Drink responsibly.
Yes.
Okay.
And only if you're of, you know, the proper age, et cetera, et cetera.
Yes. Agreed. We have time for one more.
Okay. Hang on. One more. I gotta find it. Gotta find a good one. Hang on.
Yeah.
Okay. This is a question from CW. Hello, CW.
Hi, CW.
Hey, Bibbs and Rockmeister. Been a minute since my last letter, but I stay current on all of your writing and podcast.
Oh, thank you.
Seibold and his piece on Hurry Up Tomorrow is a great read. Oh, thank you.
That was a great review. That was a great review.
And Bibbs, I thought your writing on Rust was one of the better I saw at handling the myriad topics related to that movie with compassion and diligence.
Oh, thank you so much. That was a hard review to write. Like a really hard one, so I really appreciate that.
Balancing act, that one, that's for sure. Quick question today. Can you break down the difference between noir and neo-noir?
Ah.
Is it simply time of production? Will there ever be another noir film because all that can exist now is neo-noir? Can you help me understand using examples of films in both subgenres? Thank you for your work and professionalism. Always a good day when your opinion crosses my synapses. Love and safety to you and yours, CW.
Thank you, CW. I have a pretty strong opinion on noir versus neo-noir, so I want to articulate it, and then Whitney can tell me if I'm full of shit or not.
All right. Okay.
So, first off, I want to make this abundantly clear. Noir is a banner, and neo-noir is under it. If you are a neo-noir, you are a noir. That is a thing. All right. And again, noir is really more vibes than anything else. It's a tone. It is a sense of bleakness and moral ambiguity at best. Which is why they often tend to be stories about crime, but aren't exclusively stories about crime. But for me, the distinction is this. Noir is a story that happens to be noir. Neo-noir is when you are intentionally evoking noir. Which is why most films like post-Cahiers du Cinéma tend to fall in the neo-noir category because people are very self-conscious about it. Like, it's an affect. Like, Sin City is not a noir. Sin City is playing with the trappings of noir, and you could call it noir if you really wanted to, but it's definitely a self-conscious noir. So, for me, it's just one of those things where they're all noir, but neo-noir is, ever since we actually codified the genre, this was something more of like a more of a tendency than a specific genre when it started out, then it became neo-noir. It's kind of like how revisionist Westerns are now just all Westerns. You know, like it used to be America had a tendency to make, and there are exceptions to this rule, but the majority of American Westerns tended to be somewhat simplified tales of larger than life, derring do, or at the very least drama. And there, again, there are exceptions. The Oxbow Incident, great example. But around like the 1950s, 1960s, we started to see more Westerns question the assumed integrity of the American West and portray it with more violence, with more more overt misogyny and racism, and tried basically just say it wasn't that great. To the extent that now everything is a revisionist Western, but it's also not revisionist anymore because it's just what Westerns are now.
Yeah. Well, I think it's fair to separate those two things. There's like the classic period, and I remember doing a genre study when I was in college, and the way my professor put it was there's sort of like the period before the genre has really been codified, where it has like a lot of the trappings of a genre that's coming into being, but it's not necessarily always included as part of the genre. Think of something like Peeping Tom. Is that a slasher,
for instance? Exactly. I was about to say that,
Yeah, or does Psycho count as a slasher? Not really, but you know,
it's definitely Christmas does. It's definitely it's definitely building up to what would become a slasher. Yeah, it's like we call them proto slashers sort of usually, like, but yeah.
Yeah, and then there's the sort of golden age when the things really are codified and filmmakers are really keyed into something, and it's still kind of new, so it's exciting to witness. Mm-hmm. Then there comes to the point in its history when it is codified, but it becomes kind of predictable, and it becomes sort of commercial and less interesting. You can do sort of bigger things on a bigger scale, but all of a sudden it becomes a little bit more Hollywood. And then my professor pointed out, you can tell that a genre is dying out when it starts to get really weird. When some filmmakers start to really experiment with it, or it becomes really kind of self-aware. And that's when you know that it's no longer sort of, it's not an exciting new thing. It's not mainstream anymore. Now it's kind of falling down this drain of deconstructionism. And right. I found that to be a really interesting way of looking at the arc of the way genres tend to move.
Yeah. And that's so typical. There are definitely exceptions to that. Like, I think that the weird deconstructionist slasher scream ironically revitalized the slasher, but generally speaking, that's more or less right. Yeah.
So when it comes to film noir, what's the cutoff? Like 1958 or 59, right? Like films made in the 60s, I think, don't really count as classic era noir anymore.
Yeah. I would argue that for me, neo-noir basically began with films like Breathless and Shoot the Piano Player.
Yeah. Well, when they became
self-conscious.
And that's like the self-aware thing. You know, they kind of understood that they were noir. They were paying sort of homage to noir films. And, you know, great filmmakers were doing this, but they were kind of like ripping it apart again. When it comes to noir, I think it all kind of ended. Yeah, I think Breathless is kind of like the dividing point when sort of it became more about people who watch noir films than about actual criminals.
That's a great way to put
and,
it.
And that's, yeah. And there were plenty of films that were doing this in Europe. You go to film, what were some like crime films from the 60s that just like Bonnie and Clyde is not a film noir any longer. That's something new and raw. It's like something else entirely.
Yeah. That's a very different vibe. Agreed. Yeah. No, I agree. The thing about genre is that it's very, very rare that someone sets out to make one. It's usually we're taking something and we're doing it in a slightly different way, and then the way you did it becomes easy to copy, and then that becomes a genre. So that's what happened with noir. Noir was simply just sort of an attitude towards filmmaking in a time when people were making a lot of crime movies and dark dramas. And then eventually people looked at all of them together and said, There's a lot of similarities between all of these films, and we can actually start looking at them as kind of a wave. I want to try to see if I can find this. There was a writer who had just codified something that I was so jealous that they had thought of this. Here we go. It was for Rue Morgue magazine, and the author's name is, hold on. Where is it? Peyton McCarty Seamus. I hope I'm pronouncing that right. And they...
Oh, Seamus, but okay.
It's S-I-M-A-S.
Oh, okay, never mind.
Yeah, so I'm not familiar with that one. That's a little different, so I don't want to get hung up on it. But yeah, if you look at rue-morgue.com, you can read an article called Bois! It's All Connected. And it's basically it's basically looking at this wave of very grim, serious, sometimes just straight up dramas, sometimes surrealist dramas, sometimes there were sci-fi films or horror films, but basically these extremely dark and dreary films that all led up to some kind of mind-blowing twists. And they're arguing that the prototypical example of it is the Adrian Brody movie The Jacket, and they are 100% right to point to The Jacket. That is exactly the kind of shit we're talking about. And they have decided that the name for this genre, and I'm 100% on board with this, and I will be adopting it, these are bois movies.
After the musical Sting.
Yeah, like bois, like, oh shit, I just found out who Kaiser Soze is. That's early. But like, oh shit, I just found out who Tyler Durden is. That's a proto bois film. It's definitely on that wavelength. Or what was that was it Stay? Was that a Ryan Gosling movie?
Oh, that weird, like, sort of psychedelic one.
Yeah. Which they say, like, oh, my life is so fucking weird. Everyone's just kind of doing a Jacob's Ladder kind of thing, basically, in the 2000s. Right. It was very, very popular at the time. Even though, really, a lot of them weren't big hits. I remember I was talking to a, like a talent agent, actually, in the mid-2000s. And I was just asking them, like, what are people looking for? And they said every single studio right now is looking for The Jacket. Like, that's what they want. They want The Jacket. And I was like, and I'll never forget, because my knee jerk, I couldn't stop myself, response was, but The Jacket sucks. And they were like, that's not the point.
It got bad reviews. It wasn't a hit. Like,
yeah, but it hit people hard. Some people dug it, man. I don't know.
It was a bomb. It made less money than, like,
did it really?
Was made for 20 million and it made, like, it was made for 28 million and it made 21 million.
Yeah.
Why is everybody trying to,
I guess people thought, movie? I guess people thought it was a good vibe. I don't know what to tell you, man. It was right after the movie came out. Maybe, you know what? Maybe it was killing it on home video.
Maybe so.
That might be the case. 'Cause that was a time when that still happened, where you could kind of not make money in theaters, but you could make so much money in home video that you got a sequel. Like, that was still a thing that happened. So I don't know. But, like, yeah, so they someone just pointed at all these movies, like, wait a minute, these are all interconnected. We're going to call them Bois. And I'm totally on board with it. Those are Bois films.
Okay.
So I love that. We're doing them. Anyway, that is it for We've Got Mail. Thank you so much for sending us the mail. Once again, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us a physical letter if you like to the Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yes. You can also, if you're on our Patreon page, you can leave us a comment on the page. We do read those. We also have a lot of exclusive Patreon stuff. You can listen to new episodes ad-free. Again, you can sign up for our Patreon for free and get a weekly newsletter just from us. Whitney's going to have time to write some of it one of these days, too. But I've been writing a newsletter for the past several weeks with personal updates, some original criticism, and links to a lot of our work. And also, All Our Yesterdays is a podcast. We have a lot of other podcasts that we're working on right now that are exclusive to our Patreon. So patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. Thank you to all of our patrons. We can't do it without you. Yeah, we're on social media. We're on Blue Sky at Critic Acclaim. But mostly I post on my own account at William Bibiani.
Yeah, I'm at Whitney Seibel.
Thank you for writing in. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.
In Indiana, summer means more than sunshine. It's hiking miles and miles of trails to magnificent views and cruising through caves on underground river rides. It's spending the night in a floating cabin and scuba diving into your next big adventure. It's riding a horse and buggy through historic towns and camping with elephants at a wildlife park. It's anything but ordinary. Plan your trip at inindiana.com/summer.